Welcome to the Food and Faith Podcast, conversations from the soil and around the table with your co-hosts, Sam Chamlin and Anna Woofenden.
Hello again, Food and Faith Podcast. We're glad that you're back on. And Anna and I are really excited that we got to experiment with something new with the podcast this past week. The organization that I am a part of, the Keep Until, has decided that they wanted to bring issues around food and faith to Carroll County, Maryland. And so for the last 2 years, we have sponsored an event called Headwaters, where we've been exploring issues around food and faith, ecology, food justice, and rural issues. And so we held that on October the 20th, and we were really just blessed to have some amazing speakers be a part of that, to come to the place that we call home, and to have this conversation around food and faith and what is going on. Anna and I decided as a podcast, we said, you know what, we should try to capture this and get it out. And so Anna was really gracious to be one of our speakers, drove all the way out to hang out with us and to present. And so we figured we'll capture this and put it out and see what happens. So Headwaters was a fantastic event, and we were really grateful for our speakers, and we've got a bunch of podcasts we want to put out now.
Yeah, one of those is from our good friend, Daryl Harris. If you listen to the roundtable, you've already gotten a bit of a taste of the wisdom and the stories that Daryl brings to this conversation. He works in his neighborhoods related to health factors and the social determinants of health, as well as working with community-based research. Along with school, Daryl serves as an advisor to the Black Church Food Security Network, the Strength to Love to Farm, and the Food and Faith Project. He's also the pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church in Baltimore. And at Headwaters, he took a passage of scripture that I have never heard preached on before and brought together the deep importance of doing the work around food justice and doing it in a faith context. So we hope that you really enjoy this presentation from Pastor Daryl Harris.
Sam said it was the best sermon he heard in 10 years. So, no promises, but we'll see what happens. So, in Baltimore, we have something called the food desert, right? And so, the food desert is a bit of an antiquated term these days. It was a national term that was adopted by lots of local municipalities, Baltimore included. And it's supposed to show an area, geographic areas, that don't have healthy food available in those areas. And those areas tend to be areas also with high levels of crime. They tend to be areas with high mortality rates, high infant mortality rates, lots of car accidents, lots of theft. They tend to be areas where people die the youngest. There are areas where there's high incidence of morbidities, so things like cancers and hypertension and stroke and diabetes, and everything bad happens in these areas. Right? Everything bad you can pretty much imagine. And so the term was first called food deserts, and that term has. No one uses that term anymore. It's not on the national list anymore. They don't use that term. In Baltimore, they have something called, they renamed it as healthy food prioritization areas. And I said, clearly it's not a priority, otherwise it wouldn't be an issue, right? It's not a healthy food priority. And then there's some people who call it food apartheid. And the reason why they use that term, it's just a jarring term. It's something that really a lot of people either love it or hate it, right? It's quite divisive. But the reason why that term is used is because it tends to fall along racial lines. So a quarter in Baltimore City, if you're black, 25% of the black people in Baltimore City live in the food desert. If you are white, it's like 1 in 11, something like that. And so. So it falls along racial lines. The area, every area that is designated as a food desert area, is they're all black neighborhoods. they're all neighborhoods where usually people haven't decided to live there. They've been kind of assigned that neighborhood. There's usually like a lot of, there's public housing kind of in the middle of it. And then the people who have houses adjacent to the public housing, they tend to have moved there because there was no other place they can move. And now that they're there, there's no place that they can move out for most of the people. Not for everyone, but for most. So this is the kind of places that I'm talking about. And so I was in Baltimore City. You go to a lot of conferences, we talk about it a lot of times. So I'm in the church, and we're talking about it in the church. And people are asking, well, what is it really? And I said, oh, it's a place where people don't have, you know, there's healthy food is not available. And I'm like, no, really, like, tell me something more. There's gotta be something more to it. Can you explain it to me theologically? And then so I start combing the text, looking for passages, stories that can give some type of theological explanation, definition as to what these areas that have low healthy food available are. And so the natural temptation is to just find a text about famine, right? And see how people are responding to famines. But that wouldn't be accurate, because a famine means that there's no food growing. It means that there's no food available in the entire region, right? Like in the municipal. So if there was no food in Baltimore, then a famine text would be appropriate. But there's no food in these clusters within Baltimore. Outside of those clusters, there's tons of food, right? People are throwing away some. The food is so much, people are just throwing it away. And so I couldn't use a famine text, at least not a text that's famine alone. I had to have a text that there was food around, but there was a certain population who couldn't access it. And so I found that text in a scripture that is not something that is preached on very often. Maybe I've never heard a sermon on it. It's not a part of the lectionary. So if you follow the ABC year and they have the sermon, the texts that are chosen, it's not, I don't think it's a part of those texts. But it's a text out of 2 Kings. It's a text out of 2 Kings. And I'll read it just so we're all on the same page. And then I'll talk about it. And so the verse is 2 Kings chapter 6. It starts at verse 24, and it's going to go until verse 30. And so here it reads. And it happened after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. And there was a great famine in Samaria. And indeed, they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver, and 1/4 of a cab of dove droppings for 5 shekels of silver. Then as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him saying, Lord, help, help my lord, O king. And he said, if the Lord does not help you, where can I find help for you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press? Then the king said to her, what is troubling you? And she answered, this woman said to me, give your son so that we may eat him today, and we may eat my son tomorrow. And so we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, give your son that we may eat him, but she has hidden her son. Now it happened when the king heard the words of the woman that he tore his clothes, and as he passed by on the wall, the people looked, and there underneath he had sackcloth on his body. Then he said, God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today. So what's a food desert? A food desert is a place where the children suffer. Most poignantly, most often, And that suffering oftentimes leads to death. And so in this text that I just read, Samaria, which houses, it's kind of like the capital for the northern kingdom of Israel. Judah's the capital, or Jerusalem's the capital of the bottom kingdom, kingdom of Judah. And so Samaria has been besieged, right? So there's like the people that put a circle around it. And so nothing can come in and out unless you pass through the circle, but the circle is full of people who are like, they're gonna fight you, right? So you can't come out and nothing can come in, because if they come in, then you have to fight the war. And so the people are inside. And as the people are inside, what they have, they consume. And then eventually they need more supplies, but they're unable to get more supplies. And so things that are worth very little money become expensive. All right. And now if you ever visit the neighborhood where my church is in Baltimore City, and you go to one of the corner stores, everyday things are super expensive. You ever try to buy soap from a corner store, right? It's like $5 for a bar. If I go to Target, because I don't like Walmart, if I go to Target, right, I'm getting like a dozen bars, or at least a half dozen bars, for the same price that I get one bar at the corner store where my church is. You go there and you try to buy, if there is a place that has some whole food, some produce or something, it's going to be astronomically priced. It's going to be twice as much as it would be other places, right? So the goods are, you know, so people are spending more than they ordinarily would, and they're getting back from that very little. So in this town of Samaria, they said that some droppings of bird dung was like 5 shekels of silver, right? 5 shekels of silver was like a half year salary. So it's a lot of money. And so one of the second characteristics is that the king, the leaders who are aware of the situation, might be feeling the brunt of it a little bit. They don't really have an adequate response. And oftentimes, the more you bring it up, the more exacerbated they become. Right? It's like they don't want to talk about it. Right? They know it's there. They know that something's happening, but you know, it's like, what can I do? This problem is too big for me to solve. They just kind of throw their hands up at it, and then they don't really, you know, there's no plan in place to try to address it. That's what the king did for the people of Israel. He's walking by, and the woman stops him, and she says, "Listen to me, oh king, will you please let me tell you my story?" She said, "What do you want from me? If God didn't solve your problem, I'm not going to be able to solve your problem." And that's the attitude of many of our leaders. They say, "This problem has been going on for the past 40 years. I'm not going to solve it. There's something wrong with those people there. They need to work harder or do better. Let them solve their own problem. They need to pray more." But they don't really address it. So it continues to fester. And really, it continues to worsen, right? And the only people that are really added to that community are people who are also enduring large amounts of stress. Anybody who's capable of escaping has escaped already. And so things are overpriced. Things that shouldn't be overpriced are overpriced. The leaders have no adequate response. And in fact, in this text, once the leader hears the story about the women and what the women have done with their children, then he's saddened by it, but he looks for a scapegoat. He blames the prophet who told him about the war in the first place. So he's looking for somebody. He's looking for some easy way out, some easy solution that he can place the blame. And that can, you know, this problem is just because of this person, and therefore they should just, you know, take all the blame for it. And this happens every day in the political circles. around these areas that are just places of grave suffering, really. I mean, there's no better way to describe it. And then, of course, the worst and the harshest thing is that the adults turned on the children. And so you have one mother who does something that is really unthinkable, right? It's unfathomable that she would, one mother would try to convince another mother to sacrifice her child, and that a woman could actually be convinced to do so. But this is what desperate people do, right? Desperate people do desperate things. Doesn't make it right, but this is the tendency that we see in the midst of desperation. And if you come to the neighborhood where my church is in Baltimore City, those poor children, the mortality rate for teenagers in that neighborhood is twice the city average. And the city average is high because neighborhoods like that exist, right? Otherwise, the city average would be quite low. But this is twice the average. Does that understand what that means? So like, this is like an outlier, so it's pulling the average this way. So the average is kind of in the middle, but then this area is still twice the average. Arrest, twice the city average. Juvenile delinquency, twice the city average. Lead paint poisoning, twice the city average. Reading rates for elementary school children, way below average. Reading rates for high school children in proficiency, way below average. The school has a library, but no books in the library. The child, through entitlement projects, might have free or reduced breakfast and lunch, but they may not eat dinner. Homes are broken. Right? This is the description of an area that doesn't have adequate food. Description of an area that is frankly depressed. And so the adults who is supposed to be protecting the children eventually turn on the children. And so the children don't know who to trust, right? And so in our neighborhood, of course, we have police officers, who several of them are quite fine, several of them are quite good, but at an off glance, you can die. You can die. A police officer can kill you off an off glance. If I do an off glance and I run, I could end up with a broken neck in the back of a police van. And no one is held accountable. All right. They're gonna say, there's no fault here. It's against policy to have people in the back of the van without having them properly locked and secured. This person wasn't properly locked and secured, but there's been no crime. All right. The person shouldn't have been arrested, but they were arrested anyway. But no one's to blame. We'll have, of course, there's this incident that played out on CNN and all the news networks where you had children who I think they threw rocks at the police officers. And then the police officers, well, that was kind of the highlight. That was like the midst of the uprising. There was the children threw rocks at the police officers. What wasn't shown was that the children were supposed to be on their way home. And there's one big hub on the west side of Baltimore where everyone kind of comes through, whether you're a child or you're a working adult. They come to this transportation hub, and then there's all the buses, and there's a train, and there's that takes people to the varying parts of the city, and then they go from there. But the children weren't allowed to. They set that depot down during that day. So instead of the children kind of dispersing to their homes, they were all there together and kind of corralled. And then, of course, some people did some things they shouldn't have done. And then the response of the politicians were, you know, they called the middle school children, they called them thugs. The president called them thugs. Which is to say that whatever happens to them, it just happens to them, right? It's essentially to discredit their humanity. To say that if they suffer some harsh consequence, it's deserving. I mean, that's what the language thug kind of provokes, right? It provokes, it excuses violence. And so this is what is happening in the areas of my dear city where there's no food available, where I can eat carry out chicken boxes all day long, but I can't eat, I can't get beets or kale to save my life, right? There's advertisements up and down for fast food, McDonald's, Taco Bell, Burger King, all over the place. You know, have it my way right away. There's dessert advertisements on every corner, every block. But if I want a home-cooked meal, I have to travel outside the neighborhood at a pretty good distance to get it. And if I don't have a car, too bad. You just eat that Burger King for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so the challenges of the people of Israel, the people in Samaria, when they weren't able to eat right, they became desperate. They began to destroy their children. Parents began to see their children as escape goats in ways of means to an end. And all these tragedies take place. And of course, Baltimore is not so drastic. There's no army outside of Baltimore that's keeping food from coming into the neighborhood. There's no, we're not under siege in a very technical sense. But that same level of, that same sense of desperation is there. And there's no one to meet it. And then so what's a possible solution to this? And so I'm a pastor, and we go to church every Sunday, and we have Bible study in the middle of the week, and we pray, and we sing, and we read scripture, and really the heart of the church, the heart of the Christian church is really, it can be Eucharist, but the genesis of the Christian church is of course Pentecost, right? It's Pentecost. That's when the Holy Spirit comes. But one of the great challenges is that we've understood Pentecost through the way it's written in Acts, and we see it as almost a spiritual thing only. But we forget about what Pentecost looked like in the Pentateuch, right? In the first five books of the Bible, each of them save Genesis. The other four, they all describe Pentecost. They all say what it is. And of course, Pentecost is supposed to be 49 weeks after Passover, right? 49 days after Passover. 49 days after Passover. And it makes, if you read Leviticus 23, when Leviticus 23 describes the Pentecost, it makes sure to emphasize the 49 days after Passover. And in a sense, it's supposed to be like a bit of a jubilee where things that are disheveled are kind of set right. And so the Pentecost comes. Of course, you know, if you read Leviticus and during the Passover, everyone is eating, they're eating unleavened bread, right? Unleavened bread, which is called like the bread of affliction. It doesn't taste good. Doesn't have any yeast. It's not really desirable. Doesn't have great flavor. It's like eating saltine crackers, right? You prefer saltine crackers or you want mama's rolls or grandma's rolls, right? And so at the Passover, they're eating the saltine cracker. But come Pentecost, they're eating grandma's rolls. All right, they're eating good. It's harvest time. Pentecost is harvest time. Pentecost is when people who may have eaten sparingly because they didn't have harvest, or the harvest had kind of run out, the harvest had slowed down. They kind of usually just before the harvest, at harvest time, people may eat three meals a day. Just before harvest, they may slow it down to two, maybe one meal a day in ancient Israel, because the food is starting, the supply is starting to slim down a bit. The psalmist writes about this period before harvest. The psalmist says, "They that sow in tears will reap in joy, coming back bringing sheaves with them." And what the psalmist is saying is that, so of course they're growing grain, right? And so with grain, the seed is also what you eat. And so if I'm sowing in tears, what that means is that I'm hungry. And so instead of eating my dinner, I have to plant it. So that's what happens during the growing season, right? They're sowing in tears. But come Pentecost, no. It's harvest time. Come Pentecost, we're eating the good bread. Come Pentecost, we're having feasts, right? That's when you bring all the supplies that are supposed to go to the Levites and to the priestly class. You bring those. You bring the biggest offering that's going to be burnt and be a sweet aroma to God. It's the largest portion of sacrifices during Pentecost, because that's when the harvest is the greatest. And so one of the lessons that Pentecost teaches is that you have to leave the corners of your field bare, right? So if I'm a gardener, if I'm a farmer, and my field, I grew my field, I can't pluck from the corners of it. And not only can I not pluck from the corners of the field, I can't go back a second time, right? So I go through the field the first time, I get what I get, and then what I don't get, I don't go back for. And that's supposed to be left for people who don't have, for the stranger, for the widow, for the injured, for the people who didn't have a greater crop plan as you, for the people who suffered bad weather, for the people who were lazy, for the people who didn't sow in tears, people who just ate. Right? It doesn't really give you a reason. It doesn't say you only give to the people who we feel deserve. It says you leave it for the stranger. You leave it for anyone. That's what Pentecost is. Pentecost is when they took time to make sure that their land was given for everybody. And then if you read about Pentecost in Deuteronomy, one more piece is added. It says to Israel, remember that you were slaves in Egypt. So Pentecost is supposed to be a time where they remember what they went through, that they recall their past suffering, that they know that they didn't always have their fields to till, that they didn't always have the abundance that they're enjoying in that moment. That's Pentecost. Of course, in the Christian sense, Pentecost has become about tongues and flames of fire and all spiritual things, which is great, right? I mean, that's part of it too. We don't want to cut that part out. But as much as Pentecost is spiritual, it's also terrestrial. It's also a time where we are strictly instructed to remember our bondage. And some of that kind of falls deaf. If you're Jewish, then you know what that means, right? But if you're Protestant, and You know, you may never have experienced bondage. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Maybe in your lineage, there's no real reminder of bondage in a strict way. For the Gentile, at least, we can at least remember that we've been grafted in, and that what we celebrate and what we worship and what we honor is not really our own, and that we've been someone has made room for us. Right? It's not a heritage in the same way that it is for a Jewish person. And so what that looks like in Baltimore for my church, we have started a farm in Baltimore, right there in the middle of the blight and the vacancy and the crime in Baltimore City. We started ourselves a farm there. And the farm is 1.5 acres. It has 16 hoop houses in the farm. We all know what hoop houses are, right? Like a passive greenhouse. Has 16 of them. We hire returning citizens who are returning from incarceration. Of course, our neighborhood has the highest recidivism rate in the city, which means that more people from our neighborhood are going back to prison than anywhere else, which also means that our neighborhood has the highest number of people who are being released from prison to come back into in the first place. And so we're hiring ex-offenders, teaching them the skill of farming, teaching them work ethic, reintroducing them to the culture that most often shuns them, doesn't give them space. And then at the same time, we're making food available for the people in the neighborhood. And so there's two hoop houses, two of our 16 hoop houses that are dedicated to be the produce from that goes to the people in the neighborhood so that they can eat some of the food that we bring. There's a fair number of other people who just come onto the farm whenever inspiration hits them. And then sometimes we just notice that there's a whole bunch of lettuce heads that are missing. If you go there on a Saturday and you're like working the farm, sometimes you might see an unfamiliar face and you say, what are you doing? And the first, oh, I live up the street. I just came. I just wanted some greens. I'm having my family over and I just wanted to get some greens so we can enjoy our meal, which we kind of invite that because it's more than, I mean, we have more than enough. And so That's our primary work, but it's really hard. It's really hard. It's really hard to stay profitable. It's hard to meet the margins. I liked how I think Matt said he got $70,000 without trying. I've been trying so hard, I got $7,000. And so we're always looking for partners. We're always looking for people who are like-minded to come beside us and to work along with us and get behind our mission and vision and hope that help push us to success. And at the same time, as our farm is a place where ex-offenders can get a job skill and build up their resume, it's also a time where we can teach people about Christianity. Teach people about Christ. We're always using all these agricultural metaphors, but now we can actually go to the space and it can become real. So it doesn't have to be a metaphor anymore. So we can have church there. We haven't had like a real church service there yet, but we're hoping to have one. Maybe in the spring. It's starting to get cold now. People are not gonna like that. But maybe in March or April, when it gets warmer again, then we can have a church service on the farm. So I just hope that we can remember that food deserts are not just places where there's not enough produce. There are places where people are really suffering. And one of the greatest suffering that they deal with is that they are deeply depressed to the point where their children are harmed, and that the systems and the political system that is there and hoping to support them is, frankly, it's inadequate, and oftentimes there's not the interest necessary to help solve and combat these issues. And that the solution for all that, I think God has given to God's people. So if we can remember Pentecost, remember it not just as the birthing of the church, which it is, but also as a time when God gives specific instructions about how we use our land and about how we view ourselves, and that we recognize that bondage has a place in all of our histories. And so the goal is not to forget those who are in bondage now. All right, thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening to the Food and Faith Podcast. Our collaborators are Wake Forest University School of Divinity, Plainsong Farm, Garden Church, and The Keep and Till. And the music is by Paul Diemer. Follow along and keep up to date with the podcast on Facebook at Food and Faith Podcast, Twitter and Instagram at Food and Faith Pod, or on our website at foodandfaithpodcast.org.